I am Plata on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The uprisings that began in 2011, the Arab Spring that shook the Middle East and North Africa, are the premise of the new book by Scott Anderson. In the book, he looks at how deposing dictators appeared to be a triumph of democracy, instead gave way to brutal civil wars, the terrors of the Islamic State, and the global refugee crisis. Fractured Lands, How the Arab World Came Apart, is a gripping book about the complex causes of the unraveling in the Middle East and how its origins with the United States' invasion of Iraq in 2003 through to today have contributed to the region's instability and uncertainty and well into the future. Mr. Anderson's reporting, which constituted an entire issue of the New York Times Magazine last August, is the core of this book. It looks at the region through the eyes of six individuals, an Egyptian, a Libyan, a Kurd, a Syrian, an Iraqi, and an Iraqi-turned-ISIS soldier. I'll get Mr. Anderson to tell us about this book, his work, and this region. Scott Anderson is a veteran war correspondent who has reported in many strife-torn countries in the Middle East and elsewhere. He is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, whose work has also appeared in Vanity Fair, Esquire, Harper's, and Outside. He is the author of the novels Moonlight Hotel and Triage, and the nonfiction books Lawrence in Arabia, The Man Who Tried to Save the World, and The 4 O'Clock Murders. With his brother John Lee Anderson, he co-wrote War Zones and Inside the League. This new book is published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Joining me from Charlottesville, Virginia today, please welcome to the Plant Online program, Scott Anderson. Mr. Anderson, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you, as a reporter, I guess you first went to the Middle East about 25 years ago, is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's actually been closer to 30 years now. It was the mid-1980s.
Yeah.
It was my first trip there.
And so from the mid-1980s on to today, I mean, it's a very different region than it once was. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when I say the Middle East in the mid-1980s, it was you know, specifically to look at the Israel-Palestine issue. There really wasn't much, politically, there wasn't much going on in any other part of the Middle East at that time.
Yeah, and so
of course that's all changed now, of course.
Yeah, and so when you go there now, is the mood amongst the people there, is it dangerous? Is it pessimistic?
It's enormously pessimistic in almost every place, in almost every country. For this project, I went to about a half dozen countries in the Middle East over a year and a half period, and I would say in almost every country I was in, and that's Libya, Egypt, Iraq, Iraqi Kurdistan, Syria, Jordan. It's deeply pessimistic, and in most places, people feel that there's absolutely no room for improvement on the foreseeable future, or that things are actually going to get worse.
So on paper, the Arab Spring looks like a good thing, and then I realized, well, on paper it looks good to me because I'm from the West. I mean, was it necessary though? I mean, or better yet, was it inevitable that these despots that were in power for so long that they be deposed?
Well, I don't think that the disaster that the Arab Spring has come to be was, I don't think that was inevitable. But I think that what people should have, when the Arab Spring revolts first started, I was incredibly optimistic. In my travels around the world for the past 30 years, there's no region in the world where I found the political fossilization that you had, this utter stagnation that you had politically in the Middle East. So when the Arab Spring revolts first started, I was incredibly optimistic. I thought finally these people are rising up against the dictators. I think what nobody really gave an awful lot of thought to, and I'll include myself in that category, was what is going to, when these despots are overthrown, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, the Assad dynasty in Syria, what's going to take their place? Because these countries have been so repressive for so long. There is no democratic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And even, on a lighter version, that was true with Egypt. Egypt has never had a democracy. So when they overthrow Hosni Mubarak, they had political parties, but there was absolutely no consensus on what was the way forward.
And I guess before we continue talking about the book, I guess Tunisia is probably the best case scenario that throughout the upheaval there has been some change, right? Lasting change.
That's right. No, Tunisia is definitely the one bright spot in all this. And it's ironic. It was the first of the Arab nations to sort of ignite in the Arab Spring. And their revolution was virtually bloodless. They overthrew a dictator of 22 years. But I think Tunisia was always kind of a separate case. The dictatorship was, certainly by Arab standards, was mild. The dictator there was no Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. And Tunisia did have a tradition let's call it quasi-democracy. So, and, you know, had a very large educated population that I think very quickly they could cobble together a workable compromise in government.
So the idea that Western democracy can work in that, or democracy itself can work in that region, I mean, is that something that we shouldn't expect? I mean, would you sort of give us a view from these people that you talk to through your reporting as to what's different there than say here?
Yeah, it sounds incredibly condescending and patronizing to say that, you know, that these people aren't ready for democracy. But I'll answer your question in a slightly different way. If you look at the three countries that are in such a state of anarchy and chaos that they'll probably never actually be put back together, you're talking about Syria, Iraq, and Libya. And those are the three countries, and it's not coincidence in my opinion, those are the three countries that were artificially created at the end of World War I by the Western powers, by the French and the British empires.
Mm-hmm.
Iraq never existed before the British created it in 1919, and Syria was part of a much greater region under the Syrians, under the Ottomans, and the French and the British divided into four countries. So the West kind of came in and created these lines without any thought to the societies that function there. And what I think the real key to understanding the Arab world is that people's primary allegiance, especially in these kind of artificial countries like Libya or Iraq, their primary allegiance has always been to tribe or to clan, not even to religion, certainly not to the nation state. So when the despot, say, and Saddam Hussein is overthrown in Iraq or Muammar Gaddafi is overthrown in Libya, people revert back to what has always been their primary allegiance, which is not the nation. Mm-hmm. It is the tribe. It's a little different in Egypt, because there is a sense of national identity in Egypt that goes back 3,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to see the same fracturing, the same disintegration of the nation state in Egypt that you saw in Iraq and Libya. But so to the question of, you know, are they ready for democracy? I think this is a huge component that people just don't really sufficiently take on board, which is that you're not really dealing with a nation state in the way that we in the West think of it.
So what do you think we in the West need to consider when we're trying to say fix this part of the world, which we think we need to?
Right. I actually think that at this point the West has made such a hash of the region. I don't even know if any people in the Arab world think that the West in general, or the United States in particular, are part of the solution anymore. What I think, my personal feeling, and I have no roadmap of how to get there, but I think the only way forward in the Middle East, at large, is that power. I don't think the nation state really works. So I think power needs to revert more in two directions, more to a local level,
mm-hmm.
so that more power is devolved back to the tribe and to the clan. And then power goes more to a regional level, where people are going to be willing to cooperate for economic reasons, kind of more like a European Union. And how you get to either of those in the current climate, I really don't have many suggestions. But I think that is the way the region's headed. I don't think that Iraq is ever going to be put back together as a country.
Yeah.
I don't think Syria will be, and I don't think Libya will be.
That's the other thing you mentioned a moment ago about how they aren't nation states, is because a lot of us, when we think of Syria, we think of Iraq, we think of Libya, we think of the dictator themselves and them defining what that country is. I mean, is it perhaps then a function of the whatever land or other people that they need to gravitate to, say, dictators to.
Well, I don't know that they have to gravitate to dictators. But what I'll say, if you look at all three, you know, we're talking about those three countries, you know, the Assad dynasty in Syria, mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and Gaddafi in Libya. What those three dictators had in common, well, they had several things in common. One, you know, a brutal police state, a secret police network, an informant network that permeated even to individual households, and this kind of personality cult. That's, you know, surrounding the leader. But what all three of those dictators also did, they had these incredibly elaborate arrangements within the country with tribal leaders, or with religious leaders. You know, the Assads, they're of the Alawite religious minority. The Alawites are an offshoot of Shia Islam, mm-hmm. in a country that's overwhelmingly Sunni. So what the Assads did is they formed a union with the Christians of Syria. In Saddam Hussein's Iraq, there was this very elaborate system of a carrot and stick approach with the different tribes, where if you were on Saddam Hussein's good side, maybe you would get control of the Ministry of Interior or the Ministry of Transportation. And if you were on his bad side, you'd be left out in the cold. So there's this very elaborate system that maintained the peace and also maintained the peace, through an element of terror. But so when these despots are overthrown, or, you know, in the case of Saddam Hussein, when the Americans come in and overthrow this apple cart that Saddam Hussein has created, without any idea of what's going to take its place, this is when people revert back to their tribal identity, because yes, the dictator has come to personify the state. But he's also created this very intricate apparatus to knit the country together.
Yeah, and so then when we think of the Arab Spring and how all of this comes about, we think of course the technology aspect to it that helps spur this on.
Right.
Where do you see despotism in this world of the internet? I mean, will it be allowed to flourish now that we have all these apps and the sort and everyone has a phone?
Well, you know, it's a great question, because you're absolutely right. Clearly, the Arab Spring's spread because of social media, because people have run Facebook and have the internet and have cell phones. So people could see, you know, people in Egypt could see what was happening in Tunisia. People in Syria saw what was happening in Egypt. So it spread very, very quickly. But I think against that, you just ratchet up the forces of repression. In my book, one of the people I follow is this young Syrian college student, and he had left Syria. I met him in Greece. He joined the migrant exodus out of Syria and Iraq in the summer of 2015. And I spent a couple of days with this young man named Majd and asked him all different aspects of his life. And at one point I just said, so, you know, what is your father? His father was an engineer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, professional family. He said, so what does your father think of the Assad regime? And Maj said, I don't know. And I said, what do you mean you don't know? He said, we never talked about it. He still lived at home. He's 23 years at living in a house with your father. Yeah. And never once did you talk about politics, because it was dangerous. Yeah. And Maj said, you know, the most you would ever do is you could talk about the corrupt traffic policeman down the street who was taking bribes or whatever. But you would never, not even father to son, son to father, you know, husband to wife, would you ever say anything disparaging about the regime? So, you know, that's the level of repression that goes on in these places. So even though now you do have social media, and sure, you can, I mean, I think in some ways social media actually increases the power of somebody like Bashar al-Assad in Syria, because now people, you know, they see the images of people being slaughtered who are resisting this regime. So in a way, social media is also sending the message of if you don't stay in line, you could die.
The other fascinating thing about your book, Fractured Lines, is amongst the conversations you have with these people, is you get a sense of how the West is viewed, especially the United States. When you talk to them and how America has sort of treated the region and its place in the future, I mean, do you have a sense of what they think of the United States?
Okay. On one hand, with the Israel-Palestine issue, I think we all kind of know how the Arab world views the United States in connection with Israel. I mean, they, they certainly don't feel that America's ever been a fair broker in trying to negotiate Arab-Israeli peace. But on a larger level of American involvement throughout the region, I think that there is a sense, and well deserved, that they can never count on the Americans, both enemies and friends of the United States. America has a reputation of real inconstancy. That they say they're here today, they talk about democracy, but who knows what's going to happen in 6 months? They're going to pull out and leave us in the lurch. So I think America has a real reputation of just not being somebody, not being a power that you can rely on or trust in any way. And that certainly has gotten worse. It takes different forms in each administration. Certainly there's a huge animosity towards the Bush administration because of the invasion of Iraq, but also a real leeriness about the Obama administration because it was seen as toothless and vacillating. And I haven't been in the region since Donald Trump's taken over, but I can't imagine they're hugely reassured by him either.
And so what part then do they think America should play in the future? None at all, perhaps?
I think they would probably prefer none at all. Yeah. And I say that, and certainly that's not the case. If you think about human rights activists or people who want a political opening in these countries, but I certainly don't think that the average Syrian or Iraqi or Egyptian now thinks that America in particular or the West in general really have much of a role in their countries.
And so what about the rest of the West, say a country like mine, Canada? I mean, we played a part in the refugee crisis. How were we viewed there, say?
Yeah, I mean,
does it even come up, Scott?
It doesn't really even come up. I think America is really the be all and end all. A little bit of Britain and France because they were they have the colonial legacy in these countries, but it really is overwhelmingly seen as the Americans can do what they want and really can't be trusted. And one thing I was going to say one thing I found really fascinating in doing this project is it's largely about the Arab Spring revolts, but I started back. I realized I had to start with the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, because what's fascinating is how, just in the same way with the Arab Spring revolts, how you see how events in one place set off the fire in the next country over, two countries over. If you look at events like the American invasion of Iraq, that had a huge knock-on effect throughout the region, in some positive ways for different regimes, but usually in a negative way. And I'm thinking in particular of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, who already suffered from this image by his countrymen of being America's lapdog in the region. And so when the Americans invaded Iraq, which was hugely unpopular, among the population of Egypt, it just further cemented Mubarak's image in the eyes of his countrymen as the Americans' lackey, and really weakened his position. So there's this very interesting kind of knock-on effect you see, from one country to the next through the Arab world with events in other places.
As someone who's followed your work, as I have over the last couple of years, and especially in reading this book now, what strikes me is your ability to cultivate the sources and talk to the people that you do and gain the confidence of the people that you talk to, because you talk to someone who's a member of ISIS as well, right?
Right.
Have you any advice as to aspiring journalists, say, who see your work and want to do what you do in terms of how to talk to people even?
Well, yeah, I mean, the kind of journalism I've always done, and I've always done what's called, long form feature writing. I've never done hard news. I've never done daily news. And so I've always had the luxury of going to places and spending a long time to develop a story. And I write very long stories, not as long as Fractured Lands usually, but, and so I spend days and days with people, And I think that's the only way you can really kind of get under the surface of a society. You have to spend a lot of time and to really kind of understand the nuance of a place and understand, you know, even something as simple as body language. Body language changes from one culture to the other. And you need to spend enough time with somebody so that they really come to trust you and really open up to you. So if it's six people I follow in Fractured Lands, you know, each one, on average, I probably spent two, three days talking with them and talking about all aspects of their lives, you know, their childhood, their hobbies, their, you know, what their career aspirations were. But I just spent a lot of time with these people. And that's what I would advise. For any aspiring journalist, I would say don't cut your teeth on the Middle East. It's just gotten so dangerous. Yeah. There's a lot of other places in the world that where interesting things are happening and important things are happening, but the Middle East has just gotten very, very tricky and dangerous to work in.
Of the six people, do you still keep in touch with them?
I do. I keep in touch with four of them. Waqaz, the ISIS fighter, I interviewed him when he was a prisoner of the Iraqi Kurds, and he has probably been executed now. I'm almost certain that he is dead. But four of the other people, I stay in email contact with, and Facebook, and I check a couple of them have Facebook pages, so I can check what they're doing.
And so what have they told you about what you've written about them, not only in the book Fractured Lands, but when that piece came out in that whole issue of the New York Times Magazine back in August?
Right. The response I often get from, and it kind of ties into my answer before or advice about journalism, whenever a subject that I write about reads what I've written, they're always a bit surprised at how details that go into their lives. Yeah. Like, they're always a bit surprised at things that they said to me that I sort of stored away. So I think often they're a little bit discomforted by just kind of how much they revealed. They don't realize how much, you know, they didn't consciously reveal as much as they did. But I think also people really want their stories to be told. And I think that most of the stories I do are in wars. And I've just found over and over again that, you know, if people, if they're helpless, if they've gone through horrible traumas, lost family members, there is this desire to have their story be told and to be known to the outside world. So usually, I think most people are quite grateful that I took the time that I did with them, and that people are reading their story.
And so, knowing what you know about this region, what these people have told you in the course of your reporting, you don't have any sense at all as to how this will all play out or how the story ends, say?
Well, I have different feelings about different countries. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I find kind of sad about Fractured Lands is that of the six people, the two stories that really end on the most hopeful notes are the two people who've left and are now in Europe. I mean, and that, you know, that's a pretty sad indictment of what's happening in the region. Mm-hmm. I don't see anything positive happening in Syria in the foreseeable future. Libya is going to get worse. I think Egypt's going to get worse. I think Egypt could blow up again. The Sisi regime has become so repressive, far more repressive than it ever was under Mubarak or Anwar Sadat. Mm-hmm. I think you could have another explosion there. Weirdly enough, I'm somewhat hopeful or optimistic about Iraq. I mean, I think that you could be headed to a stage where you essentially have Iraq sort of separates back into its three component parts. Already the Kurds have broken away. They're a nation in name, Iraqi Kurdistan. And I think you might see kind of a similar separation between the Sunni and the Shia regions of the country. And so you might see a calm coming to Iraq, a relative calm soon, but not in Syria. Syria's going to burn for a long time.
And there's no hope, I guess, in judging from the way the Trump administration has conducted itself, as to the United States being say helpful or improving the lot of those in the Arab world.
No, no. I mean, you know, the bombing they did of the airfield. You know, what was it, 3 weeks ago? Mm-hmm. That was a one day story. There's no policy towards Syria in the Trump administration. I mean, I can criticize the Trump administration for a lot of things. I'm not sure I'd even criticize them for that. I don't know. You know, I don't think the Obama administration had a Syria policy. I think things have been so catastrophic, and you know, one disaster after another, in such quick succession throughout the Middle East in the past, say, 5-6 years, that I think the United States has just been completely reactive. You know, they certainly haven't been proactive about anything. It's just kind of responding to the next outrage that comes along. But certainly, I don't see anything out of the Trump administration to suggest that. You know, they're going to do anything positive in the region.
Well, where have you? You said you hadn't been to the Middle East since after November.
Right.
Where have you? What have you been covering as of late?
I've actually been pretty much just in the U.S. I'm starting on a new book about the early Cold War, so uh-huh. I've just been doing research on. I mean, I'm actually at the University of Virginia today doing research in their archives. So I'm following a group of early CIA officers who all came out of kind of espionage unit of the American Army in World War II, and then joined when the CIA was started in 1947. And it's a really interesting time to cover the CIA because it was the real cowboy time, you know, mm-hmm. through the late 40s and early 50s. They were doing all kinds of... dropping anti-communist partisans behind the Iron Curtain and overthrowing governments and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty fascinating time.
You've covered all sorts of war-torn regions. I mean, did you miss that part of it at all when you say stateside doing book work, if you will?
You know, to answer honestly, yes, there's a part of me, fortunately, I think it's a diminishing part of me that misses it. But yeah, if something big happens somewhere in the world and, you know, coup happens or civil war breaks out, I do have this impulse to jump on a plane to go there.
Yeah.
But against that, I think especially of the Middle East, it has just gotten so terrifyingly dangerous there. You know, if you're operating anywhere where ISIS is, you just always have to worry about, you know, so it's not even, you're not even worried about combat now, you're worried about, you know, being kidnapped and held and then beheaded, and it's just gotten really nasty. And then in the countries where it's not dangerous, where it's, you know, ISIS is not operating, they won't let you work.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how I don't think I could report in Egypt or in Turkey again today. I think they would just not let me in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's become very difficult that way. But you know, I've been doing it a long time. Also, I have a young daughter now, and it's kind of a cliche in this business that when you have children, you start thinking it's time to get out of covering war, and so I'm kind of that cliche. So mm-hmm. it's definitely had that effect on me, becoming a father.
Well, I'm a great admirer of your work, and you told us about this next thing that you're working on. I'm greatly fascinated with the Hiss case, and so.
That's a great case. Yeah,
I'm sure you touch upon that, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Well, we'll await that. But till then, I mean, I urge people to pick up Fractured Lens because it is an astonishing piece of journalism. And congratulations on all of it, and continue good luck with this book.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. I really appreciate it, and it's a pleasure being on with you.
The book is called Fractured Lens, How the Arab World Came Apart. It's published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Its author, Scott Anderson, joined me on the line from Charlottesville, Virginia. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.